My name is Justin. I'm an alcoholic. It's going to be difficult to follow up that last speaker. She was awesome. When I started speaking with my mother originally years ago, when I started speaking with my mother originally years ago, the idea that I had was like, all right, I'm going to go in and share, you know, my brutal stories and all the trauma that I've been through. And then my mom's going to come through, kind of fill in the gaps and, you know, talk a little bit more about recovery. And what I've realized over time hearing more and more Al-Anons is y'all are way gnarlier than us. You know? So, an example for that is my mom has said to me multiple times, you know, I don't believe I could ever survive your life. And the bottom line to that is I couldn't survive hers, you know. So I started using when I was about 12 or 11. She knows better than I do. I grew up in the rooms. I've been going to meetings since I was like born, 3 years old maybe. My dad has 30 plus years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I've been asked the question of, you know, if you grew up in the rooms, and like when I was like seven, my dad took me to visit one of his sponsees in the hospital that tried to hang himself. He had bruises on his neck. And so I saw firsthand like what drugs and alcohol, the effect that they have on people and how they can tear apart lives and families. And so people have asked me, you know, like, if you grew up in that, how could you like want to try drugs? You know, why weren't you turned off? And when I was that young, my opinion on it was, well, all these people are throwing their lives away and destroying families and committing suicide for these drugs. Well, they gotta be fucking good, you know, if they're doing all this for them. So it caught my interest, as sick as that sounds. Anyways, I started when I was 12, and I've always been really open with my parents. And I remember the first day I smoked weed, I saw my mom and my dad, and I told them right away, and I was like, you guys are good. Like, I didn't like it, you know, and I didn't my first time. And but what's so strange is in the beginning, like, I don't want to say I forced it, but I kind of did. You know, I had this, like, draw. And then at a certain point, I remember that, you know, which you hear all the time in AA meetings, you hear other alcoholics talk about it, this feeling of warmth and comfort and this feeling of understanding, like, this is what I've been looking for. And I remember thinking, like, sounds crazy now, but I remember thinking, I want to be the best at using these, use the most, and distribute the most. That was, like, my goal, you know, at a young age, 13 or so. And it progressed really, really fast. I got arrested the first time at like 15. I don't know, it's tough. I don't want to get into like necessarily too many stories on it. There's no reason. You guys have all heard it. I'm sure you have obviously family members or kids yourself that have been through similar situations. But, you know, I've totaled six cars. Car accidents are like a huge part of my story. I'm very lucky to be alive. I've overdosed more times than I can count. I've seen a lot of people overdose. I've seen death a lot. By 17, I was doing heroin, and that was when everything changed. Before that, it was like, you know, I never really found anything that stuck other than weed. And sorry, but the consequences of smoking weed for me are not bad until they lead to the other things. So I found heroin, and that was it. You know, I knew, like, this is what I want to do every day for the rest of my life until it kills me. And that lasted about 7 months. And from 7 months of smoking heroin, I was homeless, walking around Agoura Hills with a laundry bag full of clothes. And I went to my first... first real treatment center. I went to a few IOPs at about 13 or 14.
Could you raise the mic up a little, please?
Mm-hmm.
Just yell at him.
Yeah, I know. It's hard. I'm sorry.
hold it.
All right, is that better?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Sweet deal. So I went to my first treatment center. It was a sober living, actually. It was in Century City. It was called Liberty House. I was 17, and it was, at the time, it was horrific. It was very structured. It was like almost like military for your mind, not so physical, but it was all about ownership and holding each other accountable. And anyways, I hated it at the time, but reflectively looking back, that place taught me how to grow up. It taught me how to be a man. It taught me how to be accountable for my actions. And I remember going in there, and my parents just loved it, you know. And every time they would come and visit me, I was like, get me out of here. This place is horrible. And they wanted me to do about 14 months there. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do 14 days. 14 months is insane. But at about 4 months of being there, they gave me the privilege of going on my first day pass. And I was supposed to go water skiing with my dad, and I went home at night, and I knew the second I got home, I'm like, I'm not going back to that place. There's no way. And I was on probation at the time, and I told my dad, you know, I'm not going back. There's no way. And he's like, all right, well, we're going to call the police then, you know, or call your probation officer, and you have to go back. Like, we're not taking you back. And I grew up in Simi with him and my mom in Agora. And so I'd always grew up in this house in Simi, and he got remarried very recently and just moved to this brand new house in this new neighborhood in Thousand Oaks. And he had been there for like 4 or 5 days. So fifth day there, new neighbor, and there's cops all lined up on the street. Because I told him, when he said call the cops, I said, go ahead. Like, I'm not going back. Call them. I don't care. And so I'm talking to the cop outside, and after shooting it around with him, he's like, you know, you can go back inside. And I'm like, my stepmom's not gonna let me inside. Like, they hate me, you know. I've caused a lot of destruction. And he's like, no, you can. And he's like, I'll go with you. So we go to the front door, and my stepmom opens the little like latch. There's like a little window on the door, and she's crying, and my dad's tearing up, and I was like, I'm looking at the cop, like, I told you, not gonna let me in. And he goes, you guys need to open the door and let this kid in, because he's a minor. So if you don't, I'm going to have to take you both to jail. And I'm sitting there like, gotcha. Like, I win. No, honestly, though, it was a horrible feeling. And I didn't feel so good about it. I just didn't want to go back to that place. And so the deal was, they wrote up this contract for me, right? And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I think a big reason, a relapse is a huge part of my story, and I think a big reason for that is I tend to fall into this pattern of following my father's or other people's recovery and not finding my own. So part of the deal was, they wrote up a contract of what I have to do, and it was as specific as like what kind of meetings I need to go to, like what type of sponsor I need to have. And I didn't care. I just didn't want to go back to that place. I was like, you know, I'll do whatever you want to do. So anyways, I started my path of recovery for the first time. I got about 10 months. And I knew kind of the whole time, you know, I'm kind of just doing this to be sober or to be not be homeless. But I knew eventually that I would go back out again. So I spent that time sober mainly setting my life up in a way where I could live on my own and use the way that I wanted to. And my excuse that I had built up in my head is, when I move out, I'm just going to smoke weed and drink. And that thought is the most insidious thought ever. I've done it so many times. I don't even like smoking weed and drinking. Like, I don't enjoy it. I actually don't enjoy the effects produced by either of those drugs. But for whatever reason, every time I've gone out, that has been the initial, you know, step that I take. So when I say, you know, weed is not dangerous initially, it's the most dangerous for me, you know, because it sucks me right back into that same state. So that's what I did. I got an apartment. I got an apartment in Van Nuys, and started drinking and smoking weed, and about 3 months went by, and everything was actually okay. I was like kind of holding stuff together, and it was all right. I'm like, hey, I might be able to do this, you know. I was 18 at the time. I'm like, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Maybe I'm not a drug addict, you know. Maybe I can make this happen. And I just remember feeling bored. You know, the effects produced by weed and alcohol were just not enough for me. So I did the same thing that I always did, and it starts with, you know, I make the excuse of, oh, pharmaceuticals are not going to, they're not as bad, right? So it's not heroin. So I start with Norcos and then Oxycontin, and then before I know it, I'm on heroin again, and then I'm selling heroin again, and then I'm using needles, and then I'm carrying guns. And I say that because I'm a fairly small white boy from Thousand Oaks. Like, I shouldn't, that's not, it's not my natural environment, right? To be quite honest, I have to try really hard to survive in that type of environment. It's not, doesn't come naturally. It's not particularly easy. So anyways, things got really bad. I was living with my girlfriend at the time, and I was on my way to work one morning, and same as any morning, and I have this thing with when I'm loaded, where if I'm like blacked out, the number one thing I want to do is drive. Don't know why, it's just what I do. So I'm on my way to work, and I'm not blacked out, but I was dozing out, and I nodded off, and my foot, you know, stepped on the accelerator a little bit harder, and I ran to a tree going 90. I broke both my feet, and they put me in the ambulance, and we're just sitting there, and I'm in all this pain, you know, and I'm like, why are we sitting here, you know, why am I not, you know, getting pain meds or whatever, and they tell me, you know, we're waiting for the police to arrive to see if this is a DUI situation. So immediately I realize, like, I have heroin in my system, so I just lose it. I start crying, and I'm like, I need pain pills, you know, and the second they give me morphine, I know I'm in the clear. So they gave me morphine, and anyways, I'm sitting in the hospital like an hour or so later, and a cop comes in, and he's like, I need a drug test here, and I started laughing at him. He's like, what? He looked at me, gave me this look of like, he knew exactly what was going on. He knew, like, well, whatever, I pulled one over on him, I guess. But anyways, what followed shortly after that was my memory recollects it very strangely. So I continued to sell drugs in a wheelchair in Van Nuys. And I had this apartment, and I remember slowly watching my girlfriend and all my things. It was like a time lapse. If you guys have ever seen a time lapse, like everything being taken away like by wind, and all my things were taken away, and before I knew it, I was completely homeless in a wheelchair. And that experience took me to places that I didn't think I was capable of going. I just went through a lot of really gnarly things. Losing the necessities that you live with every day, like showering, brushing your teeth, figuring out where you're gonna get food. Not having those things is a very strange and traumatic thing to go through. So I'm in and out of treatment centers in a wheelchair, and I had gone to Tarzana multiple times, and one of the times I went in there, I was on crutches at this time. They're like, well, at least you're kind of getting better, you know. I ended up, what happened after that? Oh, so I go to Tarzana, and I'm like, okay, I'm ready to go. Let's do this. And I meet this kid in there, and he's like, yeah, I sell drugs for a living. And I'm like, great, well, let's start this road again. And did that whole deal again, and sold to everybody in the treatment center. It spread like a virus. I feel terrible about that, but anyways, after I did that, I was in a hotel room on Sepulveda, and I called my mother, and I told her, yeah, I'm gonna die, like I need help, I need to get into treatment again, and I had just left treatment, and she said, I can't help you, there's nothing I can do for you, but I can give you a number of this woman. And so she gave me, I don't know if she was your sponsee at the time, but gave me a number of one of her sponsees, and she came to pick me up and took me to this place in Hemet. I don't know if any of you guys have been to Hemet, but it's a terrible place. Anyway, so I go there and they run my insurance, and my insurance did not cover the treatment. And my mom's sponsee called my mom and said, you know, I'm going to pay for it. Like, he's going to die. And she had gone through her own addiction things as well, so she understood the place I was in. And so I get in there, and day four, I go in and I talk to a doctor, and the doctor's like, we do something a little different here. It's called pharmaceutical therapy. I'm like, ooh, that sounds nice. And they give me all these different non-narcotic prescriptions. And anyways, long story short, for day five of being in there, I overdosed on non-narcotic prescriptions. I took 114 of them. Anyways, I had this moment of clarity there. I was in the hospital, and I'm like, I didn't even leave this time. You know, I can't stop. I can't stop, and it's time. So I got into the sober living in Oxnard and started another road of recovery, and I was on a cane at this time, and I've always worked in construction, so I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I thought I might be injured, you know, for the rest of my life, and I still am, but, you know, it's manageable. Anyways, met a guy, went out to, we moved out. His parents made a lot of money, and we were best friends, and he said, look, where do you want to live? It's time to move out of sober living. Where do you want to go? And I'm like, shit, let's go to Hollywood. Sounds like the best place, you know? Long story short, bad decision. After about 7 months of sobriety, I went out again. The first time using, I overdosed and flatlined. I was flatlined for 6 minutes or 5 minutes or 4 minutes or something like that. I don't know. I was brought back by the paramedics. And you'd think that would scare me or yeah, but it didn't. It's just I just wanted to be back in that game again. And I ended up in another sober living in Simi Valley, and it was a really pretty gnarly place, and I couldn't stop getting loaded. And this segment of time was the first time really in my using career that I had I did every day. I woke up and I told myself, I'm not getting high today. And every night I would end up with a needle in my arm. I could not stop, and all I wanted to do was stop. And I had never experienced that before. Like, I had inklings in me of like, oh, I want to stop, but everything in me wanted to stop, and I couldn't. And I called my uncle finally after a while of being there and said, I need help. And I OD'd for the last time in his bathroom, and that started my road to recovery, and another road to recovery, and and I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps, and my life started changing drastically. I got to step 12 and had a tremendous spiritual experience, and I finally achieved a year sober, and then 2 years, and then 3 years, and then 4 years, and then 5 years. And my life became large. It became beautiful and filled with joy. And somewhere around 5 years and some months, or maybe even 4.5 years, somewhere in there, I forgot where all these blessings came from. I forgot the reasons why. What I had to do to maintain that sort of lifestyle. And that insidious thought of, well, I might be able to smoke weed came back in again. And at about five and a half years or so, somewhere in there, I was driving home from work one day, and I got this beautiful job that I absolutely loved. And my life was actually, from the outside, looked really good, but inside it was turning sour. I'm on my way home from work, and I wasn't thinking about it at all during the day, but I'm driving, and all of a sudden I'm like, I'm just gonna go pick up a weed cartridge. It wasn't like, there wasn't a whole lot of thought behind it. It was just, I just did it. Why? Because I had completely let go of the support and the wall of recovery that I had supporting me for so long. And I had no defense. There was no borders to help me. I had let go of all of those habits that helped me stay away from them. stay away from getting loaded. And the progression is baffling to me. You know, I started with the cartridges, and it's like, well, I'm not doing flower, so it doesn't count, right? And within 2 weeks, I was smoking 1 to 2 cartridges a day, which is just a ridiculous amount. And then after that, it was driving to work with an ice chest full of beer. Again, I don't even like drinking. And then before I know it, I'm shooting heroin and smoking fentanyl and doing all that stuff again. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. It is a horrible, horrible way to exist. And it's so much different than even when I was younger now. It's very important for me to say because the game has changed a lot. This fentanyl shit is not a joke. It is absolutely not a joke. A big thing, other than my life being in shambles and me being uncomfortable and just hating every moment, a big thing that encouraged me to get sober again was my grandfather has been a fireman his whole life. He's retired, and now what he does is teaches CPR. Years ago, I went to his class and taught CPR, and at least 10 people would be dead if I didn't know CPR, at least. It became a common thing where people would come to my house and want to try exactly what I was doing and take one hit and be dead. And I would have to keep them alive. And to be quite honest with you, I got really sick of it. You know, if I wanted to do that, I'd be a paramedic. And it's not what I want to do. It's traumatic and horrible to watch. So anyways, I just say that. It's not a joke. It's not like how it used to be at all. Shit is very deadly, very scary. How I've made it through, I've gone through large periods of my life with survivor's guilt, not understanding why I survive, like why is that, and this time getting sober again, it's pretty clear, you know, finally, it's pretty clear. Like I'm obviously sober to share my experience, like that's the reason, you know. If one person hears my story and it changes anything, like my job is done, like that's it, you know. Countless times I've woken up in the morning, I'm like, why am I still here? Why am I still alive? Why am I the one that survives? And that's it. I'm really, really grateful for this whole convention. It's awesome. Absolutely awesome. It's cool to be around people again and be able to be close to people again. So thank you for everybody that put into effort setting this up. I don't know. I really didn't think that I would survive this time around. But I'm so grateful that I did. And every day gets better and better and better. I get to do stuff like this, which is awesome. You know? Absolutely awesome. And I get to hear my wonderful mother speak right after me, which I love. Anyways, that's all I got. Thank you so much.
Yeah, eat it. I'm short. I don't have to hold it. Hi, I'm Jody. Really grateful to be here. Thank you, Jason. The speakers were so great, and I'm just like, I laugh, I cry, I love conventions, I love being of service. I was so excited when Jason called and he said, would you like to speak at the convention with your son? I haven't been to one in-person meeting yet, and I immediately said yes. I was like, yes, we're in, you know. And this time around, you know, with Justy, I had to say, right before the pandemic hit, we were asked to speak also at the San Fernando Valley Convention. And it was the first time I ever had to turn it down because Justin had started using. So when we were asked to speak this time around, I got to say, you know, it's one day at a time. I have no idea if he'll be sober when it, you know, I have no idea. He's sober today, and, you know, he just got a little over 90 days. And the reason I say that is, being the Al-Anon that I am, the first time that my son got sober, I knew to the moment that he got sober. I knew his date, I knew the time, I knew why, I knew where he was. I don't own his sobriety date anymore. It's not mine. I don't know it, because it could change at any time. We were just sitting in the car, only because I'm freezing to death everywhere. So we were sitting in the car together, and I said to him, he's like, you know, one day at a time. Us alcoholics, us addicts have one day at a time. And I'm like, no, you got 1 second. Like, this is it. The second we've got right now. And he also had made the statement about the last speaker, who was great, Lisa, so great. And he's like, wow, you Al-Anons are gnarly, you know? and it's so true. It's so true. And for me, it's driven in different ways, you know, with ego or fear or whatever that is, that impetus for me to want to fix or control somebody else. I remember calling my sponsor as soon as Justin and I were asked to speak, and I'm like, what if he's not sober? And she's like, and what if he's not? And immediately I was like, all right, so they just hear me. Oh, well, it's all good. Because, you know, I don't know. I have no idea. When I was chairperson for VCAAC, the night before, I have this perfect speech, I'm ready to go. It's like, I'm the chair, you know, people will be looking at me. You talk in front of a lot of people. And the night before, we're picking this young man up, and he's drunk all over the middle of the streets. And my friend and I, we took him to a meeting, and I walked into the meeting and I said, I got a drunk in my car, come get him. And that was it. And the next day I got to tell that, instead of whatever my speech was that I was going to say, because that's the disease, and that's how it affects our lives. I have no idea from one day to the next. I just have none. I got into these rooms because I married an addict. I was raised in the disease, but neither one of my biological parents are addicts. They're both Al-Anons and have the Al-Anon behavior. My mom lives in it and just thrives in it. But I learned what it was like and how to be the person that connects to people that like to have a good time. That's, I guess, the best way to put it. I have this thing that I even do now. I'll go into an Al-Anon room, especially if I'm living in a different area. I've had the blessing to be able to live in different places, so I hit rooms all over the place. And I'll walk into an Al-Anon room, and I'll be there for a while, and I'll go to a few meetings, and I realize, oh, there's somebody in the room that I really like. Like, oh, I want to get to know them. This isn't an Al-Anon room. Now I know, step back and wait. During the break, are they going to be the one out smoking? During the break, am I going to find out that they're a double winner in both meetings? Which I know we don't say double winner anymore. I don't even know if that's pejorative now. So lucky to be in both programs. So I'm learning that I have an attraction. And it's not about tuning into them. It's about tuning into me. What do I feel? What's happening with me right now? Do I need you to like me? Do I want you to like me? Do I need to? And that's all it is. Because otherwise, I don't need to. I just need to show up for me. I just need to be there for me. And like Justin says, I come up here and I fill in the little gaps with Justin. He was 12 and a half when he had his first drink. He was 13 when he used. And he started going down that road, and it was pretty heavy. And my kid, I like to share, he is a rock star under a rock. There is zero in between. Those little parts where he thinks he's got it together, he is sliding so fast that it happens so quickly. From this side, we have funny stories too. They may sound tragic, but if you do not look at the sense of the humor in this side of the insanity, you'll get lost and you'll bang your head up against the wall, especially if it's your child. I had 15 years in this program. before my kids started using. Lucky for me, I had two before he even was born. So when he started using, I got 15 years under my belt, right? I've got sponsees, I've got this great sponsor, I've got my shit together, everyone, you know, like, I'm great. I'm the guru of Al-Anon. So not. Somebody said, get to a parent focus. You got to get into a parent focus room. Wow. Humility in a moment. I sat with these women and I sat with these men and I listened to their stories. As was said earlier with the speaker earlier, don't mortgage your house. Don't give up your savings. They're going to do what they're going to do. And Justin was raised in these rooms, like he told you. He knew the lingo inside and out. He knew what to do. He knew what to say. Like his story about the cops being called at his dad's house and his stepmother's house, he knew. He absolutely knew that they weren't going to take him away. He knew that they were going to make him open the door. He knew. He was extremely savvy. So in that, I had to learn from people before me that I can't direct this. I can't navigate this. I have no control over this. It took years in the rooms and wonderful parents that have lost their kids, that are still going through it with their kids, that could look at me and could tell me, it doesn't matter what you do, and it doesn't matter what you say. You will never get your kids sober. That is not up to you. You do not get to own that. He will never walk up to the mic and say, I got sober because of you, Mom. Not going to happen. He got sober for many things, but they're not my things. So my emotional sobriety is attached to what I do here in these rooms and the people that I connect with and my sponsor who I had 30 years in December, and I don't know about you guys, but I still work my sponsor. Like, I feel for her. I call her a lot and I talk a lot. I am a talker. So I feel really blessed for all of the people that have come before me. In the way of our story together, there was one point when Justin was living in Hollywood, and this was before he started using again. And I looked at him and I said, do you wish you had the life that like your cousins have, that are going to the right college and have the right bank accounts and have all these things? Do you wish you had that? And he said, no. He goes, you gave me dignity. You gave me the dignity to fall. And then you also gave me the dignity to get back up on my own. And he goes, how could I ask for anything more? And I thought, wow, that's incredible. I mean, I couldn't figure that out for myself. I knew because I would reach out and I would ask, what do I do next? My kid's out on the street. What do I do if he shows up? You don't let him in the door. You don't let him shower. You don't feed him. You wait till the cops show up. They'll talk to him. Sure enough, if he didn't show up at the door, and he shows up at the door, and I'm like, I can't let you in. Mom, I gotta come in. I can't let you in. You know, I had to tell another mom at one point, she's like, I saw your son on the street. I want to pick him up. I want to get him food, and I want to give him a shower. And I said, please don't do that. And she called me back, and she said, I'm going to do it. And I said, if you do, then I have to call the police on you for aiding and abetting a minor. The woman never talked to me again. Never. But Justin showed back up on my door. I hear in these rooms, teach your children how to have self-respect by having your own self-respect. Teach your children how to have self-care by having your own self-care. And I had to practice that. At one point, Justin went into one of his rehabs, and I took him in the day before I was leaving to go to Europe for a few weeks. And his dad at the time didn't tell me that the next day he checked himself out of rehab. And when I got back 3 weeks later, I found out Justin was out of rehab, and you know, he had been out on the streets and everything like that. And I looked at his dad and I said, why didn't you tell me? And he goes, because there wasn't a fucking thing you could do about it. So enjoy your vacation. And that's a gift. at the beginning, excuse me, at the beginning when his dad was first getting what was going on with him, and I tell you this because I own a shirt that actually says it, he said to him, he goes, "I'm going to go to an Al-Anon meeting because your mom seems to have this down a little better than I do." And Justin got up at a meeting one time when we were sharing, and he said, "Yeah, so my mom's going to Al-Anon, and then my dad starts going to Al-Anon, and my mom took my dad to the dark side." And I found a shirt when I was in Hawaii one time on vacation when my kid was out on the streets again, and it says, "Come to the dark side, we have cookies." And I thought, you know, this is so perfect, because we do. And our cookies are our hugs, our handouts, when we pick up the phone, when we stand next to each other and we support each other for that one more time we did get our kid off that street, for one more time when we did make a decision that maybe we loved him too much. So I'm really grateful. I love that t-shirt. I'll have it forever. Hopefully I'll always fit into it, but you never know. There was also another time in Justin's using where he talks about when he was out on the streets and he was in a wheelchair. And I lived farther away and I lived up north. And I came and I picked him up, and that's what I would do. For Justin, what was important for me is I made sure he had a toothbrush, he had deodorant, and a phone that was workable. And I don't know why, because he didn't call me. But it just made me feel like if he was going to live under a bridge somewhere, like he would be safe. And I picked him up and I took him to a movie and I asked him, and I mean, he looks bad, really bad. Cigarette burns in his shorts and just really disheveled and doesn't look good. And I asked him, I said, "Where would you like to eat?" And he said, "Red Robin, because they have bottomless fries and it's not very expensive." And I thought, wow, okay. So that's what we did. And then we went over to the movie theater. And we go to order popcorn. And the kid is going to take the order, right? So he's looking down and checking in. And we're just saying what we want. And Justin says, "I'd like popcorn and soda and something like that." And the kid looks up. And he looks at Justin. And he literally, like, stepped back. And he was like, "Oh, wow." You know, like, the kid didn't know what to do. That's how bad Justin looked at the time. And Justin looked up at the kid and he said, "It's okay. You don't have to feel bad. It's okay." And later on that same day, I called a friend and I said, "Can Justin come over and shower?" And I came back to Justine, she said, "Absolutely." And I came back to Justine and I said, "Hey, we can go over to my friend's and you can take a shower." And he said, "No, my turn is next Tuesday at the homeless shelter." He goes, "And that's what I get to do, because I get to reap the circumstances of my behavior." And like he said, he learned accountability young, plus I'm really big on that. I don't think life comes at you, I think we bring it. So I feel really grateful. At sometimes I even call him my little Zen addict. He has this sense about him. He is my teacher every day, whether he uses or he doesn't. He shows me how to be humble in the face of this hideous disease. He shows me how to be humble when I'm in mine. I've been on the phone with him numerous times where he's like, "Hey, when was the last time you went to a meeting or called your sponsor?" You know? And I'm like, "Yeah, whatever, kid." But it's true. You know, sometimes it's really, really true. We get to laugh together now. We're both over talkers, so sometimes we talk too much, and we looked at each other and we both laughed with the last speaker when she said, "No important conversations after 9. That's when we get started. It's like midnight. We get time together and we love getting deep and we're just like in it, right? It's like we're in the muck and it's midnight and we're just like, oh, we're exhausted. But we love and we cherish the time we have together. And especially for me when he's sober, Christmas, not this last year, but the year before, I went and I spent the day with Justin the day after Christmas, and he was bad, really, really bad. He couldn't get through any of it. And I brought like four or five presents for him, and as he opened them, he would cry even harder, and he'd say, you know, I don't deserve this, and why are you here? Why are you doing this? What is it? And I looked at him, I said, it's not about you anymore. It's about me. I don't show up for you. I show up for me. It makes me feel good. I don't have to save you. I don't have to change you. I just have to respect you, and I just have to honor you. That's all I have to do. You're either going to make it through this day or you're not. And that's not mine to own. What's mine to own is to be loving and have compassion. And to be able to do that, knowing that when I walk away, I have my own life. And I have a good life. And I do things and I experience life. I went to Asia for 30 days by myself. I'd never been anywhere out of the United States by myself. And it was fabulous, and it makes me realize, why do I ever vacation with people? Like, people are great when you meet them out on the streets and you don't know them, and you're like, yeah, I don't even know you. I have friends all over the world now that I met on that vacation. But going on vacation with people, like right now, Justine and I are sharing a room. He's great, but man, the kid's up all night, and he's like eating stuff and bag noise, and I'm just like, this doesn't work for me. You know, I like my earplugs. I just want to go to sleep. So realizing that if I can step back, at one point Justin said to me, and this was in sobriety, he said, I don't know if I can do this anymore. And I had had enough time under my belt, and I had great sponsors, and I've done my work, and I do my steps, traditions and concepts, and I have wonderful sponsees. I looked at him and I said, that's when I told him, I don't think I could do your life either. And he's like, I don't know if I could be here tomorrow. He was letting me know. And I said to him, I said, well, I want you to know, I'll never hold it against you. It'll wreck me, but I'll get past it. So you do what you need to do. And I love you. And that was in sobriety, his sobriety. But what it made me realize is that I have my sobriety, and that's what I have to hold on to. Because my line between being compulsive and not being compulsive is just as strong as his line. I can cross it at any time, any time. At one point when Justin was there during his using this last time, it was also that few days after Christmas, he calls me and he says, that's it, I'm gonna do it, I'm gonna take my life. And I knew he had a gun. And I called my sponsor and I said, what do I do? And she was fabulous. She said, you call him back, call his bluff, and say, you're gonna make a wellness call. Well, I knew my kid had drugs all over his apartment. That's not gonna be good. So I call him back and I said, I'm gonna make a wellness call on you. Kid loses his mind. Don't you dare call the police. Not going to happen. I'm not going to do it. It was a cry for help, but what I realized, I'm not the help. That's hard as a parent to understand, to even comprehend. I am not the help. Another addict is the help. It's falling down and hitting your head on the porcelain bidet, if you're in a nice enough bathroom. That is your help. It's figuring that stuff out for yourself. That's not me. This isn't my journey, his addiction. My journey is my recovery. And that's what I live in, my recovery. I live in the women that I have held me through divorces, have held me through breakups, have told me no matter what choice I make, they will love me. I remember calling who has passed and I love her dearly, Cindy P. I called her one time and I said, and the reason why, mind you, because I called my sponsor at the time. I called my sponsor and I knew my sponsor was going to tell me no to what I wanted to do. So I called Cindy P. And Cindy P. said, and I don't know what it was with me and her, but I would catch her every time when she was in Target. She's like, how do you do this? And I said, I want to get him at least food. So can I get a gift card? And she said, you can get a gift card, you know it'll go to drugs. Or you go and you get him, and you take him out for food. And I was like, okay, I could do that, you know? And it was the practice of listening to the women that came before me and the men that came before me. And don't get me wrong, I am a truth teller. So I am not, I tell my sponsees, this is not a program for the weak of heart. It takes a lot of strength to be in these rooms, to show up, a lot of courage. So at one point, I was, this is what I do, I'm senile. I totally lost my train of thought there, so we're going to bypass that and hope I get back to it. I remember just being able to pull myself together enough to know that I can go to a room and I can pick up the phone. I can read my literature. I can do my steps. When somebody asks me to sponsor them, now mind you, at the beginning, I didn't know this. I actually learned this from a stranger. A young girl came up to me and she said, I'd like you to sponsor me, but I'm scared. And I was like, why? What are you afraid of? She goes, I heard you're mean. I'm like, and of course it's me. I'm like, I'm not mean, I'm great. I'm so not mean, I'm the nicest person. And she goes, well, your sponsee said you're a little mean. So I went back to a few sponsees. I didn't know which one. She was good. She kept anonymity. And I went back to a few sponsees and I said, am I mean? And they said, no, you're not mean. But you don't let us bullshit you. You call us on our stuff, you know? And when someone asks me to sponsor them, I get to tell them honestly now and not hide behind the fact that, oh, I'm such a nice person. I get to say, you know, I can be tough. I can be tough. I'm gonna call you out. I'm gonna catch you on your loops. I'm gonna let you know there's nothing you can do about that. You can't change it, you know? But you guys taught me that too. You taught me to have my own integrity for who I am, to own who I am and not feel bad about that, not feel insecure about that. I feel more insecure with wearing the wrong outfit than I do with who I am today, you know, with the knowledge that I have. And I show up because I need to be here. I need to be here. I can react, I can be reactive, and I have to practice every day not to do that, you know, to pause in the moment, to understand when I am pausing, what does that mean for me? Can I breathe here? Am I letting my serenity seep out of me in this moment? Or can I contain it and keep my jar full for myself? And so it's a practice. It's a big practice. I'm grateful today for everybody that made this experience happen. And I am so grateful to my son that he's willing and that he's open to try to look at life differently every day. To switch our own narratives is not easy. We have learned things and we take them in and we think that's the way it's supposed to be. We fear the past because we're afraid it will be our future. And to be able to shift our narrative, to know that our future can be different, that's huge. And I'm grateful he chooses to do that for himself. And this is where I get to have my lessons too all the time. I used to think that if I go to this meeting, oh my God, I can't keep going to this meeting. I can't hear their stories over and over again the same way. you know, I got to go to different meetings. And don't get me wrong, I do go to a lot of meetings. Lucky with, I have sponsees in Perth right now. I have sponsees in Italy. I go to New Zealand meetings. I go to meetings in Bali. I love and hate the pandemic. I love the fact that I got to experience international sobriety, emotional sobriety. Like, people are out there everywhere. We are not unique. We're not unique. So the reason why, and I don't know our time, but the reason why that we also like to do Q&A is so much comes out of Q&A, where Justin and I get to experience through you what it's like. Like, we get to address that and we get to identify with it because we know we're so close to it. And I'll share one more thing. We were at a meeting once and we were speaking together, and it was a smaller meeting, and this woman went for Justin with a vengeance. Just went for him. And she was brutal, and this is an Al-Anon, right? Just brutal. Every mommy thing in me just was like, I'm gonna shred this woman. When I get up there, I'm gonna shred her, right? Justin put his hand on me, and I looked at him, and I said, how are you so calm? And he goes, I'm her son. I hurt her. And that's all she's doing, is letting me know I hurt her. And I thought, okay, I know how to be nice too. And I realized if I could show that I could get past the hurt, so can she. So I thank you all for being here and for listening to us.